How's everybody doing? All right. Some of the time, anyway, our practice can take a sudden turn towards the depths when things aren't so easy for us. And I noticed that again. This week, my brother went into the hospital, and fortunately, nothing too terribly wrong. But I noticed that it's very easy to kind of edge away from the three characteristics of sentient being existence. And those are? Usually number one is dukkha, unease. Anyway, the order is not so important, but so unease, and somebody mentioned impermanence. Yeah. And the lack of a verifiable self. And since those teachings have a little bitter taste to them, I myself am overly fond of sweet things. So if something's a little bitter, I tend to try to sneak away from it. Of course, you can't. But when I learned that my brother was in the hospital, it was like a body kind of little shock. And the shock was the sudden return to the necessary contemplation of the three marks. Our human world has a lot of really wonderful things in it. And it's our tendency, just our karmic tendency, to concentrate on those. And sometimes in so doing, we lose track of what is actually beautiful about them. And as Suzuki Roshi put it, something that's beautiful is always, as he said, slightly losing its balance and toppling away. So most beautiful flower or work of art or sunset or music or something, it's always losing its balance. there's it's a very beautiful film of a one of the really really great figure skaters. I don't remember his name, but there's a short film clip of him in, I think, a competition, and it's quite breathtaking to watch. And in a way, the most striking thing was, it's as though he was always slightly off balance and completely in control of that, with the result that there was this magical manifestation. And in San Francisco, I noticed they had some posters up for, I'm not sure what it was, an exhibit of some kind, perhaps. And the posters were of Václav Nijinsky, great, great ballet dancer. Who also manifested this extraordinary quality. Uncontrolled control. I don't know if it was a group hallucination, but people said that his leaps, which were quite extraordinary, he was immensely strong. He actually seemed to pause at the top, and nobody could figure out how he did that. But then, of course, at the top of the leap, there's the pause, and then there's falling away, returning to earth. And poor Nijinsky, maybe because his magic was so powerful, his mind became non-functional, and he died in an asylum. So there it is again. The enormous beauty that is always slightly receding. And the attempt to make it hold still causes nothing but trouble. And the fact of the matter, of course, is we're not holding still. We may be sometimes in the grip of the illusion that we're still, and then everything else is kind of happening around us. But of course, that's not really the case. There is a way in which we are still. And that way is the way in which everything is still. And what our sitting practice, our zazen, is based on that peculiar dynamic. The Perfect Wisdom teachings, perfection of wisdom, courtesy of this lovely lady on the altar there, they teach that in spite of the detailed and seductive manifestation of things happening in the world all the time. There's no fundamental change. There is only ceaselessly relative change. All things changing in relation to each other, including us. So it's a little bit paradoxical, maybe, to have a practice, a cultivation where we're pretty still. And in so doing, we are manifesting harmony with an entire universe. And the more we become acquainted with that harmony, but it's more like the more that harmony becomes acquainted with us, the less we will be, caught off guard. When we are suddenly obliged to notice that everything's losing its balance. And falling into and away from great beauty. So it may not be immediately clear to us, how do we carry on in the midst of such circumstances? Fortunately, Shakyamuni Buddha turned up at I guess just about the right time. And began to teach people how to live under such circumstances. So there's quite a lot of Buddhist teaching around. One very old synopsis of Buddhist teaching you've probably heard before. This is an old verse from Pali collections. It's the one that goes... Sabba papassa karanam kusala sumpasampada sacitta parildapanam etam buddhana sasanam. This old verse says, no doing of evil. No doing evil. Pali and Sanskrit word papa means, you know, all kinds of things, an offense, an injury. Sometimes people translate it as sin, which I don't think is perhaps very helpful, but something like that. So none of that. And then kusadasupasampada means being endowed with everything wholesome. And wholesome for Buddha meant everything that allows us, that helps us to see clearly. Everything that helps us to not be enchanted by illusions. And then sacitta pariyudapanam. Sacitta is just, you know, one's own mind or thinking. Cleansing or clearing away, something like that. Clarify our own mind or thought, which again means dispensing with illusions. And this etam buddhana sasanam, teaching of all the Buddhas. So even way back before people were thinking about the Mahayana, the great vehicle, there's this reference to multiple Buddhas somewhere. So according to this teaching, all Buddhas teach this way. First of all, don't do any bad stuff. Secondly, try to understand what are our illusions and see through them. And try to come to recognize our own confusion and kind of sweep that away. And this teaching, as is the case with quite a lot of Buddhist teaching, went through a certain transformation over the centuries. So in our precept ceremonies now, we have this teaching, but it's worded a little differently. And there's more than one version, but the one I'm used to is the one that says it's a vow that we take. We say, I vow to embrace and sustain upright conduct. So what's upright conduct? Basically, upright conduct is conduct that does not spread the three poisons, which I'm sure you all know what those are, right? Huh? There they are. Yeah, so we vow not to spread the three poisons. And our old friend Dogen, whose 817th birthday was last week, in his kind of cosmic way of looking at things, he says, he refers to this vow, and he says, that vow is the abode and the source of the law of all Buddhas. So that vow not to spread the three poisons is the very heart of Buddha's law, and law just means the way things will work such that liberation is facilitated. Let's see, what's the next one? Next one is I vow to embrace and sustain all good. So there's that, actually, that word again, kushala. Everything that is wholesome. Everything that does not propagate illusions. Everything that allows us to see clearly how things are. And of that one, Dogen says, that is the teaching of utmost perfect awakening and the path of one who practices, and that which they practice. So the teaching of perfect awakening is the actual path away from the illusions which tie us to a world of suffering. There's an actual path that unfolds in front of us as we take the steps of practice. And that is not other than those steps that we take in practice. For instance, sit down and be still, among other things. And the next one, where the old version was kind of edge away from the mind, somehow the new version takes a leap over the centuries there. And the new version came out sounding like, I vow to embrace and sustain all beings. And that, Dogen says, is transcending profane and holy, and taking self and others across. Across where? Well, across the sea of suffering. And as you probably know, this trio of vows is sometimes called the three pure precepts. And it's like, well, why are they the pure precepts? Well, if you reflect on them, you may find it's a little difficult to find a foothold there. Those precepts are like a mountain of glass. You know, astonishing, powerful. But you can't really climb up them. Instead, you get to let the vow operate in your life. Since no one actually knows how you go about embracing and sustaining all beings, I don't know, but you can invite that vow into your life over and over again. In so doing, to some extent, we're swimming against the current of karma. Which is kind of tiring sometimes. Because the current of karma is always trying to carry us into a little eddy or whirlpool where you just sentient being's life is marked by unease, impermanence, and no verifiable self. So every time we take our seat, whether literally or figuratively, every time we establish ourselves not in stillness, as stillness, we are counteracting the current of karma. And sure enough, that, among other things, is the teaching of utmost perfect awakening. The path of practice. And those practices that constitute the path of practice. So that's actually happening right now. You may have your doubts, it's okay. But it is so. So every time we embody those vows, those pure precepts, the universe, as we participate in it, changes just a bit every time. This is how the path unfolds. So as I was contemplating my brother and his fortunately not too grave illness, I was having a little dialogue with myself and saying, did you really think you were going to get away without encountering such phenomena in your life? And I answered myself back and said, no, I didn't really think that. I just sort of thought that. And I knew such things were bound to happen. But I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about them. But when there's actual threat to our own well-being, or what we perceive as a threat to our own well-being, someone we care about, or our own body starts to remind us that it's falling apart at a greater or lesser rate, sometimes there's this, it's like, oh yeah, I almost forgot. Fortunately, the body-mind is capable of sustaining quite extraordinary shocks. So it's okay. We're, I probably watch too much TV, but anyway, you hear people say, I can't deal with this. I just can't. Can't stand it anymore. But actually they can. And as they declare, I can't deal with this. They're actually dealing with it. So we're funny that way. As has been said before by others, this body-mind has tremendous strength. And part of the path of practice is that strength becomes available to others. Without any program on your part to make that happen. at some point in a Dharma talk, you got to wonder, okay, is that enough? My beloved teacher, particularly during retreat, he would get so enamored of the practice that he would go on for quite a while. There you are in Sesshin, and someone's giving a 75-minute Dharma talk. And then there's questions. But I usually don't like to talk that much, so. Maybe you'd like to talk. Oh, yes? Oscar-san?
Next week in this temple, we'll be doing a full moon ceremony. And I wonder if you could remind us of the text that you were teaching, that you're talking about this evening, Dogen's text.
Uh-huh. What is it?
Yes.
I don't know if I've ever seen it in its entirety, but those brief comments on the precepts are usually called the Kyoju Kaimon. Kyoju Kaimon. You know, mon is probably gate, and kyo, I don't know what that is, probably not sutra. Jukai, bestowing precept, gate. So the something bestowing precept gate. Yeah, those are his comments, including the comments on the 10 prohibitory or grave precepts also. And that, just to refresh our memory, so you got your three refuges, three pure precepts, and 10 grave precepts, making the 16 bodhisattva precepts, which is our favorite system of concretizing upright conduct. Yes?
When you were speaking of an old Pali verse before, the origin of some of our vows, were you speaking in Pali?
Yes, that was Pali.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were a Sanskrit scholar.
Well, Sanskrit and Pali descend from a common ancestor. Pali is what's known as Middle Indic. Sanskrit is Old Indic. So they are closely related. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Raphael.
Greed, hate, and delusions.
Mm-hmm.
What is the connection, the relation of the three? And which is the worst? And how do one rid themselves of them?
Mm. I don't have like a metaphysical explanation for how they are related. Buddha was very clear that they are the hub of the sentient being's world, the hub around which the wheel turns and turns and turns. As I see it, they're all three kind of equivalent in potency. Each of us tends to find that one or the other of the three dominates. And I've said many times, I'm a hate type. Alas. There are also greed types and confusion types. But even though one predominates, the other two are also present. And the way to blunt their efficacy is to clarify how we see the world and ourselves in the world. You could say, well, that's kind of dispensing with illusion. Yeah, kind of. And to do that, withdraws energy from the mechanism of the three poisons. You will find this for yourselves, if you maybe think you haven't already. You will notice that as our willingness, our settledness in the face of things as they actually happen, as they actually are, as that grows, the likelihood of our being carried away by the currents of the three poisons decreases. Now, this generally doesn't happen overnight, so patience is recommended, but it does happen. Algumas?
For the short amount of time that I've been coming to these meetings, I've heard the name Dogen, but I'm not sure.
Dogen?
Dogen.
Mm-hmm. Who he was?
Yes.
Yeah. He was the illegitimate child of an aristocratic family in 13th century Japan. He lost his parents at a young age, which had a significant effect on him. His uncle was the abbot of a Tendai monastery near Kyoto. So as a kid, basically, he began his study of the Buddha way as a Tendai monk. And he showed extraordinary ability right off the bat. And at some point, he heard that downtown in Kyoto there was a monastery started by a chap named Eisai, who had been to China and had returned with the Linji or Rinzai lineage of Zen. And then they were practicing that together, so Dogen went and practiced with them. And Eisai was quite old, so maybe Dogen didn't get to spend much time with Eisai, but Eisai's student, Myozen, became Dogen's teacher. And eventually conferred on Dogen the responsibilities of lineage holder. So Dogen was responsible for the Linji or Rinzai lineage. And at some point, when Dogen was like, you know, really young, 23 or so, he and Myozen got the idea that, you know, maybe, what if, you know, here we are way off in Japan, nothing but ocean to the east of us. What if we've gotten things a little bit wrong? Maybe we should go back to China and see what's happening and see if we really got the last word. So Myozen and Dogen went to China to see what was the practice there like. And after not too long, Myozen died in China, which was probably a little more trauma for poor Dogen. He was suddenly by himself. His teacher had died. And So he went from monastery to monastery for a while, and he was about to go back to Japan, kind of discouraged. And someone said, well, before you do that, you should go to Tiantongshan and see this guy, Ru Jing, nay, the abbot of Tiantongshan.
The cook, the mushroom?
Oh, the cook. Did the cook guy tell him that, or someone else?
The guy who came to buy mushrooms.
Yeah, the mushroom guy. Anyway, somebody said, don't go back to Japan until you go see Ru Jing. And Dogen went and saw Ru Jing and had a great opening. And Ru Jing was teaching a different lineage, the Soto and Saodong lineage. And Dogen finally felt like his life's work had been accomplished. So after about 5 years, he went back to Japan and announced, okay, everyone, I'm back in Japan and I have the last word on Buddhism, which did not please everybody. But anyway, enough people were interested that he got some students and established the Saodong or Soto lineage, which we inherited to this day. So that's who he was. And he's really old now. Yeah. Okay. You all are looking pretty good tonight. I think it's all sunk in pretty well. So,
one more thing.
Yes.
Before you leave.
Yes.
There's something that you're forgetting.
Please tell me.
Something is very startling. Does that ring a bell? Does that ring a bell?
Ding. No, I'm sorry. I'm suffering from confusion now. So could you help me out?
Hey!
Okay. Thank you all very much. Mm-hmm.